The lights are on red. We're away.
Hello, and welcome to MotoGPOD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. Today is Friday, March 21st, 2008, and this is episode 119. I am Bob Hayes, your host, here today to talk to you about MotoGP and all things motorcycling, as I am every week. So, this week we got some good stuff. We're going to start off with besides the sort of usual front matter. Besides that, we're going to start off with an interesting story/email/commentary from Fergus Caldicott, track day buddy and longtime friend of MotoGPOD. He wrote a little piece about the preview of Birth of a Racer, the Discovery Channel documentary about the MotoSys motorcycle, which was played up in Portland at the Baghdad Cafe. So I'm going to read that, Fergus's comments and everything like that, and you guys are going to be kicking me because I live about 3 hours away from Portland, and whatever reason, I will get into this later, I didn't go to this thing. So I'm going to tell you about that in a little bit. Then after that, we're going to have a call with Jules. We did a nice long call with Jules Cisek about the Stoner Mystique, some interesting sort of thoughts and comments and all sorts of stuff about what's going on with Casey Stoner. And there were some topics we didn't touch on in that call, so we're probably going to come back to it. But in the meantime, I think it came out pretty good. And I think that's about going to do it for this show. It's a little bit of a shorter one, like I said, because it's kind of making up for last week's mega marathon 2-hour ordeal. Now, before we get into the whole rest of the show, I do want to send a big giant shout out thank you to Len Padilla, who is also, by the way, the moderator at the fans.moto.gp. So go to moto.gp, fans.moto.gp. And this is a website. It's sort of the social website for MotoGP, that kind of thing. It's there's a link to it on the MotoGPOD.com website on the left side. And it's one of these, the sort of web.20 kind of thing going on with forums and all that sort of good stuff. It's a very interesting site he's got going on there. So check out Len's site, fans.moto.gp. And also, as well as Len, we want to mention Scott Simerson. Thank you very, very much, Scott. Matthew Off, which I hope I'm pronouncing your last name right correctly there, Matthew, and Derek Morrison. All of these guys, Len, Scott, Matthew, and Derek, were kind enough to donate to the MotoGPOD cause, help pay for the bandwidth, help pay for the Skype bills, help pay for the beer, all that sort of stuff, the bills that we rack up doing a podcast, because believe me, you tend to go through the beer. And I might not have mentioned it, but I actually started brewing my own beer recently, and right now, this second, I'm actually enjoying a tasty beverage of a friend's homebrew, and it's quite good. So I've been doing that a little bit lately, and who knows, maybe I'll start another podcast, although I kind of doubt it because I'm sure there's really, really some good ones already out there. So enough blathering on about beer and all that kind of stuff. Why don't we go ahead and go into Fergus's write-up here. So Fergus sent me an email, and like I said, Fergus is a track day buddy. I sort of met him through Darren Carpenter, who is our tame road racer up there in Portland, Oregon, and Fergus is Darren's buddy up there, but we've done a couple of track days together. He's a great guy. He's got a ZX10R that he rides there on the track for the PSSR track days and all that sort of thing, and he was kind enough to write a fairly lengthy review/write-up/news story about the U.S. premiere of the Discovery Channel documentary Birth of a Racer, which, if you'll recall, I talked to about last week. It's the story of Michael Siss and his dream to build a world-class racing motorcycle. And this is all happening, like I said, about 3 hours away from me up here in Portland. Michael Siss, an architect up there, and he's been doing the MotoSys project for a couple of years now, several years now. And, I've done track days where Michael Siss has been there at the track, and I've gone over there to sort of talk to him, and it's like, well, he looks really busy. So I sort of wimped out. And this is a couple of years ago when the show was still kind of new and everything, and now I just go over there and be the typical reporter and just butt in and say, hey, sorry, Michael, sorry to interrupt your lunch, but why don't we talk a little bit? So, Enough of that. Let's see. Fergus says, I thought I'd drop you a few lines about the Motocist documentary showing that happened here in Portland. There was a few things to share with your adoring fans. And Fergus has got that right, because we're very, very happy to have the fans, adoring or not. He says, it was a typical Portland spring evening with more than a sprinkling of rain, which means that it was probably pouring. Nevertheless, many of the hardy locals turned out on two wheels, and it was a full house with around 300 attendees. And this happened at the Baghdad Cafe, if I hadn't mentioned that, in Portland, Oregon. The documentary itself was fascinating. It showed the history of the Motocist C1 racer from garage product to American American contender. The element that I found particularly striking was the unconventional way in which all of the challenges were approached, from the counter-revolutionary engine to the twin-clutch slipper and the twin-spring rear suspension. The level of innovation is perhaps best illustrated by the number of patents they have pending on their designs. It's amazing that someone with no formal engineering background can apply his experienced eye for aesthetics and architecture to something as technically demanding and precise as motorcycle design. In many respects, it seems as though they may have been an advantage, as Michael Sis does not play the game by the same rules as the big boys, and he has done a great job. This characteristic is something that, to me, is very reminiscent of John Britton, and certainly so, definitely Fergus. The level of commitment from the development team was also truly astounding. They were challenged with, and they achieved, from paper to prototype in 9 months. It's clear to see what a hard struggle it's been, and while some have fallen by the wayside, most of the team remains committed to making the dream a reality. The documentary showed the initial stages of dyno and track testing, the latter being done by Jeremy McWilliams and Shane Turpin. It was incredible to see such experienced road racers stepping off of a motorcycle that totally reset their views on how things could work and feel, and how the motorcycle can be a natural extension of the rider rather than being a rocket to which the rider is strapped. After the movie, there was a 45-minute question and answer session with Michael Sis, Terry Sis, who is Michael's father and chief mechanic, David Sprink, Motocist electronics engineer, Adrian Hawkins, the engine designer, Shane Turpin, AMA racer and Motocist tester, Nicky Natch, the chief instructor at Freddie Spencer's Riding School, the author of Sport Riding Techniques, and Michael Sis' personal racing coach, and some guy named Ben Bostrom. So, a good deal of the questions were congratulatory in nature to the team, deservedly so, but the million-dollar question for me was, what class are they going to race in? Well, there was way too much development in the 990 engine before MotoGP changed to 800s, so they're sticking with, you know, where they're at, and they're shooting for superbikes. With the recent homologation requirement changes for small manufacturers, Motocist would need to sell 150 C1s to be eligible for AMA superbikes. So if you happen to have a spare $100,000 just knocking around, support that cause and go sign up. And funnily, I did notice a page on the Motocist website for reserving one. And I'm sure that actually, Fergus, I'm sure they've probably already reserved more than one of these motorcycles. I'll bet you Jay Leno's got one on order. There was also some discussion around the licensing of their technologies to other manufacturers. Apparently, Jake Zemke and Miguel Duhamel tested the CBR1000 at the end of last year with a modified Motocist front suspension. And Jake even posted his fastest time of the day with that configuration. There was also the suggestion that other manufacturers are in the fray too, notably, of course, Buell and Harley-Davidson. I'd guess this is going to be the way that they're able to fund a good portion of their future development. Overall, it was a really fun evening, a real treat to have them give back to the Northwest motorcycling community. They certainly have the odds stacked against them, but I, for one, will support them where I can, and if you can catch the documentary on the Discovery HD channel, it's definitely worth a viewing. By the way, the showing was free at the Baghdad Cafe. Thank you very much, Baghdad Cafe. But there was a voluntary donation at the door to the Road Racing World Action Fund, which, if you're not familiar with Road Racing Action Fund, that's contributes to buy air fencing at road courses around the United States. Those funds were then going to be matched by Motocist, which is very, very cool, and then matched again by Road Racing World. And even more, they're going to request that the proceeds go to air fencing at PIR, which is the track where I do most of my track racing, most of my track days up there in Portland International Raceway. And so that's kind of really pretty cool. And so while I'm here, he says he does want to mention, Fergus also wants to mention that the 2008 track day special from Road Racing World has just come out, which I was also going to mention. Thanks a lot, Fergus, for stealing my thunder. But Road Racing World's latest issue has their 2008 track day special. It's a really good read. Fergus says, showing everything you need to know about track days from novice to expert, and also lists all the track days in the U.S. this year. So it's really, really good stuff. And like I said, thank you very, very much, Fergus. Do appreciate the email there and the write-up. That thing came out, and listener, and unfortunately I don't have the email in front of me. I was alerted to the whole premiere at the Baghdad Cafe by a MotoGPOD listener, and I wish I had that email, but thank you very, very much, whoever you were. And I look at the calendar and everything, it's like, that's a Navy Reserve weekend. And I forwarded it up to Darren there in Portland, and Darren must have hooked up with Fergus. And I kind of thought it would just be, you know, you go to the Baghdad Cafe and you watch this Discovery Channel thing and you're done and all of that. So it's kind of like, you know, what with all the other responsibilities and so forth that I have going on with the Navy weekend, I just can't make it. You know, it's a further, you know, 2.5 hours away from where I would be during that weekend, and getting out late, and I wouldn't be able to get up there until probably after it started, and yada, yada, yada. So I just kind of figured, you know, I'll just miss it. Had I known, however, that, you know, Michael Siss was going to be there, his dad was going to be there, Ben Bostrom and Shane Turpin and Nick Inach and all these guys were going to be there, I would have made much, much more of an effort to get up there. So I feel sad to have missed that, but it's my bad. I should have done a little more research exactly what was going up there at Baghdad Cafe. But in any case, it sounds like it was a great event. And for those of you that live in the Northwest and managed to attend to that, you know, kudos to you, and I'm happy that you did. And hopefully here we will be able to listen to a little bit more about the whole MotoSys project on MotoGP in future events. So, there we go. That's it. Thank you again, Fergus. Do appreciate it. Why don't we go ahead and get on with our call with Jules? All right. Hey, Jules. Back again this week. How are you doing?
I'm doing great.
Good, good. All right. So, we kind of want to continue on and expand on our conversation last week that we had about talking about Qatar and talking about Casey Stoner and all that sort of thing. There was some stuff we actually had the conversation last week, but I edited it out because the show was so long. So we're going to do that again for all you folks out there that are listening. So Jules, why don't we just launch in and start right off with your Casey Stoner theory?
It's funny because there's been so much talk about the same exact things that we talked about last week since then. A lot of this might not even be as interesting anymore, but there was an article on Crash.net about Casey Stoner that generated an unbelievable amount of responses, like 500 responses. A lot of the things I'm going to say actually were mirrored in those responses. And then there's none of this is stuff that like I came up with. This is just kind of like gathering information from sources like Toby Moody interview on Rumbleship Radio. There was the Kropotkin Thinks blog post about Casey Stoner and traction control, and lots of forum discussions. I think everybody this year is looking at Casey Stoner in a different light. At the end of the year, last year, everybody was trying to convince, there was like this big, there were these two camps that were like the Ducati machine camp and the no, it's Casey Stoner camp, and then the Perfect Storm camp, right? And like I think everybody's moving towards like the Perfect Storm, but without really thinking about what that really means. And that's kind of what I want to discuss, is like the how we got there.
Sure, let's launch right into it, because yeah, I agree, and I've always been a sort of a member of the Perfect Storm camp. Not to slight Stoner's ability in any way, shape, or form. But I kind of wonder exactly what results he would have on different bikes, and I think he'd still do well. But
so I think he would do well on any 800 series bike. The thing is that every champion in motorcycle racing and any kind of motorsports has benefited from just being at the right time for their type of skill, for example, and the right machinery being available to them. I mean, there's probably been champions out there, capable riders out there that just never got the chance. You look at Valentino Rossi, he was just perfectly situated to own a new series. He was a very quick learner. the two stroke era. He came out of the 250, so he knew that those kinds of bikes. But he picked up the 990s in a very uncanny way that, you know, that the rest of the field had trouble catching up with him. And then, you know, it wasn't until the end of the era that he was even being really challenged. And that last season with Nicky Hayden, you have to kind of admit that the bike failed. It was the machine that failed him.
Right. Which led into Hayden's sort of almost perfect storm season.
Exactly. Because at the same time, he had that incredible consistency and just willpower to just persevere, you know, and give him enough to take advantage of Rossi's woes. So I think what's going on here is that Casey Stoner is just the perfect guy for the current technology. And that's what we'll talk about. And he's benefiting from the fact that we've moved to this these 800 bikes that require more traction control and more corner speed and all that kind of stuff. And I think he would do well on any bike right now. I don't know if he would be quite as dominant, but I think he would be. There's a bunch of things that he really needs out of the Ducati that do help. But I think he would do any motorcycle that has the kind of traction control that these bikes have.
Yeah. Well, going back to last year, when we saw like Stoner just walk away from the opposition there in the first several races on the straightaways, where the Ducati just had so much more power. I mean, don't you think that's something that kind of benefited into him? Obviously, it wasn't the only thing because Caparossi wasn't doing the same thing.
No, well, so the thing is that what Stoner has and what gives him the biggest advantage right now is incredible confidence and he has a lot of courage. The courage factor for him with him is, I mean, every one of these riders is incredibly courageous to ride a motorcycle at 200 miles an hour. You know, the way these guys do. Some of the onboard footage actually is a little minimizes the effect of just how close the racing is because they're using extremely wide-angle lenses. So a guy might be like a foot away and he looks like he might be like 10 feet away, but in fact, they're like right on top of each other at 200 miles an hour, every corner, constantly looking, you know, for the passes. The courage is not questioned at anybody, but I think Casey Stoner has a special kind of courage, which is the courage to like just go and like go against some even what his body is like screaming at him to stop. And the confidence factor is that he has confidence in himself. But yeah, definitely. I think at the beginning of last year, those first few races gave him he didn't maybe have the confidence yet in the new bike. I don't think anybody did. They were still all trying to figure out exactly how to ride them, and the fact that the Ducati did have an advantage, they definitely did have an advantage, gave him the confidence in the bike so that when the other manufacturers started catching up, he was already feeling much stronger on that machine and no longer knew its ins and outs, and you know, and so he was able to build off of it. So I want to talk about this courage aspect. So anybody who's been on a high-performance motorcycle and has been on a, hopefully on a on a racetrack, but you know, even your average canyon carver who has high-sided off a motorcycle knows that just how painful those kinds of crashes are and how quickly they come, and all it takes is one or two, and your body just. Well, your body knows to avoid pain. It's been evolved to avoid pain, and when you're, you know, all of the things that happen on a motorcycle, they give you feedback, like the back end stepping out just the right way or the wrong way. They all give you feedback into about the high side, and your body immediately, without even thinking about it, reacts, and the usual reaction is to roll off the throttle. It's actually something that like a lot of racing and motorcycle safety courses will try to get you to overcome that reaction, because sometimes it's better to just let the wheel keep spinning than it is to let it catch again, obviously, if you're going sideways. the last thing you want is the wheel to stop spinning. But anyway, the thing is that I think that traction control plays into this fear, because the feedback that you're getting back from the bike is different than a regular throttle, where you would normally just roll off when you get those signals back from the way the bike's moving in 3D space. You know, when you're on traction control, your bike's starting to give you the same kind of feedback, and the traction control kicks in. But for most of the riders, I think they still haven't gotten used to the fact that they can trust a bike, and to correct the situation. And I think that Casey Stoner has learned to trust this completely. And several people on various forums have mentioned how they've really listened to the onboard footage of Stoner riding around the track, and like how in every corner he is on a throttle, and you can hear that it's the TC that's working, and that he never lets off. You know, through every corner, he just never lets off, which is an ingredient of this perfect storm.
Sure. So, is this when we say not just confidence, but it's a trust thing. It's knowledge of his abilities. It's knowledge of the bike. There's so many aspects that go into this that it's something that's going to be difficult to develop.
Yeah. No. I think that this gigantic gap. Motorcycle racing is about split seconds. You know, 2/1000th of a second can win a race, as we know from 2 years back in Estoril.
Yes.
And so you might have a good pace, and you might still lose because I'm always amazed at how I remember Colin Edwards was talking about his third row start at Qatar, which was a great position for him to be in on a satellite bike, and he was saying how he made a small mistake during that lap, and that he could have done better. And you gotta think, what kind of mistake is he talking about? It's a mistake that cost probably 2/100ths of a second, right?
Right.
So these guys are incredibly aware, and obviously every little bit counts. So we're not talking about blatant differences between if you stay off the throttle during the corner for a little bit longer than Casey Stoner, that can account for a gigantic difference over 11 corners.
Oh, sure.
And certainly over an entire race distance. So if the Ducati, for example, is... We know that it's a very high-revving motor, and we know that it has what everybody in the paddock considers the best electronics. If you don't trust those electronics 100%, maybe you're not taking advantage of that full power for that 1/100th of a second... sooner than Casey Stoner is, and then there goes your lap.
Sure,
compared
exactly.
to him, you know.
Yeah.
Well, that's all it takes.
Yeah.
And so, but if you look at the lines that he's riding, he's definitely riding a different line. So he's adapted to this technology better than the other riders. And I think that. He basically enters the corner with the intent of being on the throttle as soon as possible. Rather than entering maybe a little bit late so you have less braking, he's more about the braking and getting out of there again. And I'm not saying he's doing stop and go, because you have to be very smooth on these bikes to maintain the corner speed, but he definitely gets his bikes up straight earlier.
Yeah, he's setting it up for the exit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A little bit earlier than the standard 990 rider would, who could square out the corner.
Right, I agree. And Rossi, you know, has always been a demon on the brakes, a huge, huge late breaker. And we saw this at Qatar several times. You know, he just comes in and passes on the entry to the corner. But the downside to that is that he would tend to run it a little wide occasionally. And that happened to him there in Qatar
at least once that I remember, a couple times that we saw. And Stoner doesn't seem to be having that happen as much. When if he makes a pass like that, he seems to be able to make it stick.
Yeah, he doesn't make passes on the breaks necessarily. He makes the passes on the apex. Exactly. The way he goes to the apex. So it's a little bit different.
And exactly.
I think Rossi is used to being able to hit the brakes, maybe miss the corner a little bit, but the power of the 990 and his ability to control the bike when it's sliding allowed him to compensate for that mistake, whereas now he doesn't quite have that, both because the bike is not quite as powerful. Although I'm sure that, you know, we're talking like not that much difference anymore, but the TC's kicking in, so he might not have as much control over the wheel spin. Like, I think that Rossi's style of late braking might actually be hurting him a little bit on the 800s.
Yeah, conceivably so. I agree. I mean, it's and not to you know, it's amazing to watch because he's obviously got some serious attachments to be able to do this, but it does. You do see where he pays a slight penalty for it, and I think we see that from some of the other riders as well when they're trying to do these sorts of things, and particularly also you see it when Hayden's had a difficult time, although I think he's coming to grips with it, with getting rid of that dirt tracker slide the rear out style, and we've talked about this one before over and over again.
Yeah, right. And actually, the thing about that dirt ride. The dirt track style is that the sliding is dirt style, but throttle control is something you also learn in dirt track racing. And actually, that's Casey Stoner's background, and he may not be sliding the bike around, but he's definitely controlling the throttle the way you do on a dirt track.
Right. Now, is Australian dirt track racing exactly the same as American dirt track?
You know, I don't follow it. I don't know, but I've seen photos and I've seen like small short videos, and it certainly seems like they are on a throttle through long, long corners. I don't know if it's ovals or not. We should probably look that up, but definitely same kind of skills.
Do research before a show. What are you suggesting?
I know, really. So he's got that ability to basically get on the gas a little earlier. And, you know, this whole, like, the bike kind of wobbling out of corners, and it's been mentioned by MotoGP commentators, and people are always asking, like, oh my God, he looked like he was about to lose it. That's actually not the point at which the bike is likely to lose it. You're already starting to go in a straight line, and yes, modern sport bikes, still, even with dampers and stuff like that, you can still have head shake that results in the crash. But if you think about it, in racing, that happens extremely rarely, where that oscillation gets worse. These riders all know the trick. The trick is to let the bike fix itself up. You just let go of the pressure on the handlebars and everything stabilizes again. That's just because the bike was not 100% lined up and you're on the power. The danger point is when you're before that point, and you don't get to see this little wobble before you're flying through the air. You know, it's like by the time that the wobble is violent enough, you're going to be crashing. So the traction control is helping riders avoid that.
And then it's a sort of a measure of the level of trust that they have in the traction control and experience and everything else that enables them to ride through that. Whereas a less experienced rider or somebody who's not quite as in tune with his motorcycle and all that is going to, you know, freak out.
Exactly. And all you have to do is freak out for that split second that it takes this is like faster
it's
than
a game of inches.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is faster than like brain to hand communications we're talking about, which is ingrained in the body, you know, it's like
muscle memory.
It takes incredible amounts of repetition to get right. And I think you kind of nailed it there with the fact that the Ducati was definitely a strong machine at the beginning of last season, allowed Stoner to build up that confidence and actually be able to practice it and practice and practice using it to the point where it became muscle memory.
Yeah,
for him.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, this is why these guys test. And you know, we think that there's an off season from November to March. You know, and that's 5 months, 6 months, and that these guys are just, you know, living the high life and taking a break, and they're not. You know, they get if you see the numbers, the days that how many nights they spend in the hotels in Sepang, especially, and these things like this. You know, this is a year-round job, and these guys work really, really hard. And you don't get to this level of any sport without an incredible amount of dedication, an incredible amount of hard work. And so even though, you know, like I've always said, Hayden is the company guy and his sort of attitude and stuff and his hard work and dedication, all the other guys are hard workers as well. And they also have a lot of dedication. And if they don't, they wouldn't be there.
And those that don't, eventually don't leave. They don't last very long. Yep.
Exactly. So it's, I mean, yeah, there's a lot of ingredients that go in, and certainly politics does play a huge part of getting a MotoGP ride. You know, if we decide, well, not we, but Dorna decides that, you know, we need a German rider or a French rider or a Spanish rider or what have you, those things will weigh into somebody getting a job. But still, it's not going to be, you know, that they just walk the streets of Barcelona and look for some likely kid.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you'd be taking a trip to Barcelona.
They go to Alberto Puig. No, I'm sorry.
Yes, exactly.
Exactly. I totally agree. And all these guys are doing it, but I think that Stoner did have a head start, and he does have a different kind of courage which helped him get there, because in 2006, if you examine, first of all, he was incredibly fast, and if it wasn't for his crashes, that he would have, finished much higher in the standings.
Yeah.
For a first season, it was still an amazing showing. And he, his crashes, if you look at them, he basically pushed the bike beyond the limit, kind of almost like he wanted to see what would happen. Like, he was like, look, I want to go through this corner this fast, and it failed, and he was already getting off the bike and knowing that he was crashing.
Right,
We talked about that Mugello crash several times about it in 2006 when the bike was rolling through the air and he was already walking away from the crash. It's because he knew he had overstepped the boundaries, but he wanted to see whether the bike would do what he was trying to make it to do rather than being caught out by it.
Exactly. Does he have a lot of hardware going on in his body? I don't recall reading a lot of pins and rods and plates and things.
No, I think he's been pretty lucky so far.
Yeah. So
he's been pretty lucky.
Even though he was a bit of a crasher in 2006, he apparently was a good crasher. And
he had a broken hand, broken foot in 250s.
I remember that. But I think other than that, he didn't... If I recall correctly, I think he's been very, very...
he's no Gary McCoy.
Yeah. Not many people are. but, yeah, exactly. And so that's you know, I guess that's fortunate for him. I'm not sure where I'm going with that comment, but I just
it's I think it's because if you're prepared for a crash, you're not going to get as hurt.
Yeah, that's probably true, too.
You know?
Yeah.
So the last thing I wanted to say about... the whole Casey Stoner thing is that to beat him, these guys are going to have to stop him from getting to the front, because his entire strategy relies on being able to ride the lines that he rides. And if he's in a pack of riders, he's not going to be able to do that, the same thing, which may cost him lap times. And if the Ducati gives him the power down the straight to pass somebody, then it'll be easy work for him. But I don't think that's going to happen this year. I think that this year he's going to have to really fight to get into the lead. Once he gets to the lead, I think that he's going to be unstoppable as always, until other people start figuring out this new technology as well as he did. But it is a little bit of a liability for him when he's in the pack.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, we again talking about Qatar, he didn't get such a great qualifying position and all of that, so he had to work his way up, and that's why we had for the first seven or eight laps. You know, he was not in front, and there was, we had a real full-on race going on with everybody. But you're right, once he made the front, it was, it wasn't quite an absolute done deal immediately, but it certainly kind of became a bit of a one very, very shortly thereafter.
Well, I think the reason why it didn't become a done deal is because I think Lorenzo is destined to be another rider who just gets this.
Yeah, it's a possibility.
I think he's an adaptive rider. He's a very adaptive rider, and that's what it's going to take for all the guys who are not going to adapt. They're not going to make it in this series anymore, unless there's major changes in technology or rules where they remove this traction control, some of the traction. They may put some constraints on the traction control, and people will be able to catch up, but. For the time being, there are no such rules. So
no, exactly. And even if they do that, I mean, the only way you can really, they would have to go to a spec ECU, I think. To have rules along those lines that you actually monitor and everything is very, very difficult. You can have traction control to a point, that sort of a thing.
Yep. Yep.
And we did have a threat of that last year, and I think that Carmela Ezpeleta, the head of Dorna there, sees the change in the winds and of his sport, and tends to also somewhat keep an eye on what Formula One is doing. And that's why I think that some of these things came about. I think they were like the tire thing, I think, was a bit of a threat to get Michelin and Bridgestone to basically do something about it. When we had the whole spec tire threat. But on the other hand, there's been a whole lot of chitter-chatter back and forth about all of that, about how it would not necessarily be a bad thing. That I like the idea of having a tire war because I like to see the manufacturers developing the tires and all of that. And I think that innovation and development and all that would be stymied if we when you start going to a spec rule, because it's just I don't think the same drive, same reason, same necessity to have as many engineers working on a problem is going to be there. It's not like these guys are going to simply stop developing the tires, but on the other hand, they're not going to work as hard.
Oh, totally, totally.
Yeah, that's just common sense. So,
and there was I think it was somebody in the Round 2 forums mentioned that the. This year it was really great to watch the Formula One race at Australia, because now that there's all these rules in place about the technology, it seemed like the riders actually had to really slide the cars all around. And I haven't seen the race yet. I actually meant to, because my compatriot there was on the front row, Kubica, but I didn't get to see the race. Yet, and but I'm looking forward to seeing it, and I think that Formula One has gone through this like technology discovery phase and realizing that it hurt the actual spectacle of the sport, and they adjusted. I don't think that MotoGP is anywhere near the need to do that yet.
I agree.
I really don't think that, like, after two seasons, after one season of this domination by Casey Stoner, you could say. It's the technology. Obviously, it's not the technology, and we've got a long way to go before it becomes that. I mean, the only way you could do, you could make the racing closer right now is take Casey Stoner out of the championship,
Or okay, give him a few extra kilos of weight or something.
Yeah, we ban Casey Stoner's from a couple of races, and let's see what the championship looks like. I mean, what are you going to do? I mean, you got three other guys on the same bike, and they're at the back. So,
yeah, and that I thought the same sort of thing. Did we actually talk about this, or it might have only been an email that I sent back and forth to a listener? But Daytona Motorsports Group, which is basically the France family, has got the rights going on for AMA racing. And there's concern that the way they tend to do things is, you know, that one of my theories was, you know, that basically Yoshimura Suzuki or whatever they're called this year is going to get, you know, an extra, I don't know, 15 pounds, you know, it's like, hey, you guys are doing too good. So here's some ballast. And, it's, you know, just to make sure that the racing is more even. And I certainly hope that we, and I don't really think that, but I wouldn't be overly surprised. And I don't, want to see anything crazy like that in MotoGP where they have the special stoner rule in the 2009 regulations or something
right,
like that.
Right, right. Like if your last race result was such and such, then you have to like start at the back of the grid.
Right.
Or something,
right.
You know.
And I mean you can do things like that. Yeah, there's all kinds of various rules that you can do. And those rules in a club racing environment or a lower end pro environment and stuff, those rules have a place, because otherwise, you know, people just get discouraged and they stop participating. They stop watching, you know, you lose the fan base, et cetera, et cetera. If it's always just this huge runaway, right? So to prevent that, there are series that have rules in place with penalties, basically, you know, oh, you won too many races, you know, here's some ballast. And I think it works for those series, but those series are not the pinnacle tip top. It's such a money game now, that it's a little hard to say that, you know, the way it should be is with this, you know, 6-page rule book, and it's almost completely, you know, unfettered. Let the manufacturers spend the money and do as they will, and they'll come up with the you know, may the best team win, that sort of a thing. There's so much money now that is difficult to do, but you do have to have a good balance where you're not stifling the innovation and stifling the sort of, I don't know, prototype free-for-all aspect of it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, totally. It absolutely makes sense. And I think that we're simply just not to the point where the racing has become that boring. You know, it's like...
Correct.
We're spoiled. We have had some unbelievable seasons in the last decade. But there were some... I mean, if you look at, like, you know, the 2003 season, the 2005 season. I mean, there were runaways for Valentino Rossi.
There are those that say that doesn't count. That's okay.
Yeah, and
that's what you want.
I actually have to say that there's an aspect of Stoner that really hurts him tremendously, which is that he's an incredibly boring guy. And it's not that he's shy or anything like that. He just is. Right. I was watching this like little video where they were, I guess they wanted to promote the new monster, 626, and they like were showing it to him and wanted his opinions on it. And he was basically like, I mean, I think it was probably going to be used for maybe like a you know, promotional video or whatever. But it ended up just being like a YouTube video that Ducati released, and it was kind of obscure because you can't push this kind of stuff. It's just like the guy's just like looking at the bike and going, "It's cool, it's cool." So you want to go for a ride? Okay.
Yeah.
You know? And like, whereas if you put Valentino Rossi in the same situation. I mean, he would have been like, I mean, he could turn anything into into fun. He can make everything. He's got such insane charisma. He can make anything entertaining.
Right. Exactly. A high energy level.
I mean, I bet he could talk about growing mushrooms and make it really entertaining, you know?
Probably. But he, and that's part of the whole Rossi mystique, Rossi charisma sort of a thing, is that he does have so much of that. He's the perfect showman on and off the track and all of that. And, you know, and again, not to keep bringing up Formula One, but we see the same sort of thing there with like, Kimi Raikkonen, you know, and they call him the Iceman, and there's been comments about, you know, we don't ask him to, talk to the press or whatever. And it's like, and unfortunately this is part of their job, and we know Stoner hates it. He's getting more comfortable with it, but he gets impatient with, you know, the stupid questions, because half of those reporters there aren't MotoGP reporters. You know, they're just there because, you know, it's the Australian Grand Prix and we've got an Australian racing. And so they're writing for the Australian version of People or whatever the hell, you know, kind of crappy magazine, and they're going to ask dumb questions. And you have to make it fun and interesting and all of that for them. And I think Hayden can do that. Hayden does well on these bizarre promo things that they put him into.
He's fantastic at it. He has a different, very different style than Valentino Rossi, but he's also a very entertaining guy to listen to. Totally.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Did you ever see the one that was for the Michelin dual compound tires with the sponge and all of that?
Oh yeah, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
It's amazing. I mean,
yeah. He's just doing his thing, and yeah, Rossi's got that. Some of the other guys that we see, unfortunately, you know, since we don't see a whole lot over here of advertising, I think Hopper's got the kind of bad boy attitude.
What about Colin Edwards? I mean, Colin Edwards is. I mean, he just opens another his mouth showman. And it's entertaining.
Yes, exactly. You know? Yes, yes. And he's also, Colin Edwards is part of the show live. You know, if you're there at a MotoGP event, at least particularly Laguna Seca, you know, Colin Edwards is like he almost regards it as his duty to make sure that you are entertained, you know, just from everything, from the homemade t-shirt gun and just the comments and the
sticking hats.
Hats and don't mess with Texas stickers all over the, you know, the vehicles that they get provided and all kinds of stuff. So it is. And this is all just part of their job. And I think it is one that Stoner needs to develop to become the perfect all around champion. He may need to work on that, he may not
ever actually get it because if he does, it's going to be something learned, kind of forced on him. It's going to always be a forced thing. I mean, Mick Doohan didn't become interesting until, like, you know, a couple of years after his last championship. No offense. I mean, but I think he was just so focused on the racing that off the track, he just wasn't interested in all this other stuff, which is actually extremely cool. But I think that so what I meant by it hurting him is just the fact that Stoner's hurt by it because people are not entertained by his runaway wins because there's not going to be much that comes out of it, right?
Whereas because he's not Rossi.
Yeah, and Rossi could win by 15 seconds and still everybody would be like, oh my God, that was a great race and whatever, you know?
I agree. Exactly. And I agree 100%.
I think he's handicapped in that way.
Right, and it's not like he's handicapped on the track or something, but it's just that there's always going to be this sort of cloud of doubt, maybe, or whatever you want to call it, that due to that lack of, you know, let's face it, somewhat of a lack of charisma, and you're right that's not something where you can just learn it. It's generally, I mean, it's natural. It's the way you were born or your early, you know, upbringing or. All sorts of things that's going to affect that. It's not something where it's going to be an easy task to wake up one morning and say, boy, I'm going to be much more energetic talking to the press. You know what I mean?
Yep. So. Yep. And that being said, I mean, once you take away all the external things, I personally find it fascinating to watch him ride. So to me, it is entertaining.
I agree. To me too. I mean, you know,
the problem is, I think that we don't actually get to see it because the cameras almost immediately go to look for something else going on the track,
right?
Which wasn't always the case, you know. Again, Valentino Rossi for some reason kept the cameras focused on him longer, even when he was running away.
Yeah, he still does. I mean, it doesn't matter where you're at. Like you said, if you're battling with Rossi for 10th place, you know, you're going to be on camera.
Okay, I think it was a good chat. I did want to say thanks to Cameron Lutz for making some corrections to our last chat, both when Liam and I were talking about Qatar, and both Liam and I were mistaken that in 98 Biaggi was on a Yamaha. He was not on a Yamaha. He was on a Honda. That was a minor guff there, and the bigger one is that I mentioned we were talking about the number one plates and how Kevin Schwantz didn't ride with a number one plate, or in fact he did ride with a number one plate. I checked it and it's totally true. I think I may have been remembering what some comment that he made where he felt strange about wearing the number one plate, but he did wear it. So thank you, Cameron, for those corrections. And anyone who, you know, has comments on like and wants to call us on this stuff, definitely please do. This is a learning experience for all of us.
Right, right. Got to keep us on our toes, too, because I can say some pretty stupid stuff, that's for sure. So, and I do need to be called out on it. So, I guess it's time to go, because real life intrudes. I have to go to work, and you've got stuff to do as well, or go to work as yourself, so...
Yeah, I work too, Bob.
Yeah, I know you do. It seems like you're always sort of available for calls at odd times of the day, so I figure, you know, Jules must... I don't know.
It comes with the territory. My job is just very, very flexible.
Flexible. That's good. Flexible is good. And, you know, my job's fairly flexible, too, but it's also quite 9-to-5-y in its own way. So, all right, I am going to bid you adieu. Thank you very much for the call, and we'll have you on again real, real soon.
Great. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and ciao.
That's going to do it for today's show. Hope you enjoyed it. Good call with Jules there. Always appreciate having him on the show. Next week, we're going to have a Qatar preview and maybe touch a little bit more on that Stone of Mystique like I was talking about. Special thanks go out to Fergus Caldicott for that write-up about the Motosys premiere at the Baghdad Cafe up there in Portland. Appreciate it. I'm really, really bummed that I missed it. I should have made more of an effort to make sure I attended that one. And I think that other than that, why don't we just call it a day, and we're out. Keep the shiny side up. Riding season upon us. Be careful out there. Watch out for those cagers. MotoGP OD is produced by Bob Hayes, and I am solely responsible for its content. MotoGP is a trademark of Dorner Sports SL, and the MotoGP OD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorner Sports SL. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners, and MotoGP OD is not affiliated with any of them.